This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You can't deter poverty with prison. You can't deter substance use with prison.
An implicit assumption within the structure of the American justice system is the notion that punishment is productive. Research shows, however, that locking people up does not address the underlying causes for most criminal behavior. In fact, it actually exacerbates the likelihood of reoffending. With 95% of incarcerated people expected to re-enter our communities, it seems pretty clear that our punitive practices are decidedly unproductive. This week on Sea Change Radio, we welcome back to the show Scott Hechinger, a civil rights lawyer, former public defender, and the current executive director of the nonprofit advocacy group Zealous. We talk about the set of informational films that his organization has recently produced, discuss the fight that lies ahead for immigrants, and look at the measures that are being taken by the current federal administration to push for more capital punishment. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Scott Hechinger. He is the executive director and founder of Zealous and a civil rights attorney and a former public defender. Scott, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
It's so good to be back on and good to be talking to a friend in the midst of everything going on.
Yes, I was reading an interview with Anthony Romero from the ACLU who's saying, we are at the Rubicon. It's just a question of how far we are going to cross it at this point. Why don't we first talk about the set of films that Zealous has been involved in, these short films about knowing your rights and how the immigrant community, which is immediately finding themselves under horrific threat, how they can be aware of what their rights are and how you're hoping to educate with these films.
I mean, first and foremost, knowledge is power. And unfortunately, most people, including immigrants themselves, don't think that people who are not U.S. born, that are not citizens, that are undocumented, that are even legal permanent residents but not citizens, actually have rights. And the reality is the United States Constitution, it applies to everyone on U.S. soil. And that extends to U.S. soil that's not in the continental or, you know, in the 50 states. That in a 2008 decision by the Supreme Court in this case called Bemidian v. Bush, the court ruled 5-4 that the Constitution applies to military combatants on Guantanamo Bay. And so this idea that non-citizens, that immigrants don't have rights, is a huge misconception. And so that's thing one. It's very important that people know it. And as I've been pushing out these videos that I'll share more about in one second, you know, I've been getting blowback for, you know, A, just people saying that that's not true. And they're so confident in their wrongness. It is very true. And then number two, folks threatening me and threatening others who are sharing rights to immigrants about their constitutional, or sharing information about their constitutional rights, to like refer us to the DOJ, which in fact, Tom Homan, the ICE director, did when it came to, or reportedly did when it came to AOC sharing a webinar to her immigrant constituents. Everyone has rights. And the fact that there's actually, although I don't think it would go anywhere, the fact that there's being criminal referrals based upon doing the most constitutional thing I can literally imagine, sharing information about the Constitution, is an attempt to silence, is an attempt. It's a terror tactic. But these films, they're called We Have Rights, the series of films themselves. And they're a collection of five short films in eight languages that aims to inform immigrants what to do and how to safely defend themselves against ICE overreach in the foremost common circumstances where they see ICE. So when ICE is at your door, or if ICE makes their way inside your home, or if ICE approaches you in the community, a church, a school, a court, unfortunately, ICE is doing now, and four, what to do if you or your family is arrested by ICE. The fifth film is how we, as kind of a general public, can actually document constitutionally and safely ICE arrests and ICE raids. These films are animated, and the reason why they're animated is we wanted the greatest flexibility to graft new languages and as many languages as possible over them. And they're story driven. What we saw in these films we created back in when I was at Brooklyn Defender Service as a public defender, working with my immigration lawyer colleagues and thinking through how can we get the most information to people who are really scared about the Constitution. What we found was that most of the resources out there were heavy writing, so you had to be able to read. They were only in one or two languages, English and usually Spanish, and they were dense and they were boring. How could we make story-driven, real-feeling, kind of compelling Know Your Rights materials? And we just settled on films, and we created them, importantly, not only with our immigration lawyer experts, but with another type of expert, with the folks, our immigrant clients, who had been either through this, were feeling the fear, to make sure that the things that we were actually writing and the scripts and the circumstances were as close to real as possible.
And what's your distribution model for this? How are you hoping to make sure that as many people as possible can see it? Are you going to be able to show these in schools, for example?
Yeah, so we're sort of all hands on deck any way possible. When we first launched these about 6 years ago, we partnered with the ACLU, with Witness, with a range of other big organizations to get them out. This time around, I just, the day before Trump was inaugurated, posted them up on Twitter before really having a new plan. You know, it just was like, let me get these back up there. And from that one Twitter post, My Twitter post with the four videos garnered millions of views, which then interested media company Now This and some other major accounts. And within just 3 weeks, they've been seen by over 75 million people. We're working with Brooklyn Defender Services, the organization I used to work for, and that actually where I was when we produced these films. Now to think about ways, in addition, so we're thinking about all the ways online, digital, that we can get these films out there, including, you know, showing them in schools, et cetera. But we're also creating handouts and actual business card sized information that include the rights, but it also include a QR code for folks to actually go and view the films. And these are for practitioners, for people who are in touch with immigrant communities, for them to hand them out at court hearings, in church, in schools, and anywhere where people can access information. So we're in the process, frankly, of, you know, really figuring out just any and all ways to get this information out to people, including, thanks for raising it up, Alex, coming on your show and talking about them.
Of course. And as you and your zealous colleagues have shown these films to people, I'm assuming you've had like mini focus groups. I'm curious what kind of feedback you've had in terms of some of the most common or uncommon elements of an immigrant's rights that somebody might not have known.
Before we launched the films, before we started designing them, before we started, you know, when we were just kind of writing out the scripts, you know, key with all of this was working with people who had actually been through this, with our immigrant clients when we were at Brooklyn Defender Services and talking with them, do the feelings that we're describing and do the circumstances that we're describing, do these strike true? We obviously also worked with lawyers who knew the rights, but we wanted to make sure that like the actual moments that we were showing really felt true, number one. Number two, we wanted to make sure and ensure that the language that we used was as simple and as easy to understand by really anyone as possible. And one of the early unexpected feedbacks we got was a big question over and over again about saying, what is ICE? What is ICE? We just assumed and took for granted that everyone knows what ICE is. ICE means Immigration and Customs Enforcement, broken down even more. These are the people who the government sends to arrest you if they claim that you're here legally.
As a side note, as part of the citizen test, does the United States require new citizens to understand their rights in this citizen test?
somebody who became a citizen 10 years ago, do you think they had to understand what Miranda rights were, for example?
No. Well, so I'm not, here's the deal. I'm not up to speed on what the current questions are. I know that I would probably fail the test, or I'd have to study in advance. There's like certain things that like I don't really remember. It's not easy. Folks have to actually prep for it. But the other thing, but I mean, going back to rights, the other thing that was you know, interesting that people just don't know and still don't know is that a lot of times ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, will actually slip a piece of paper under a door, hand you something that looks like an official warrant. But it's an ICE warrant. It's not signed by a judge, so it's actually not enforceable. It actually doesn't meet the requirements of what the Fourth Amendment requires to prevent unreasonable searches and seizures. But there were other things that we had in there that weren't rights per se, but that were, you know, it's meant to be just like advice, like, you know, an acknowledgement. We know that there's parts in all the videos that talk about, we know this is scary, but remember, we have rights. And just repeating the we have rights, and also just like the choice, instead of saying you have rights, bringing it and making it more kind of universal into we, that this is not just about folks who are not U.S. citizens. And the other piece was, yes, our primary audience, it was and is, of course, folks who may be coming into contact with ICE, but it's really for the general public too, to see, first of all, in these scenarios that these are parents, that these are grandparents, that these are people, these are folks that are going to work, that have been here since they were really young. They're humans too. And so there's a public education component too, not only from an empathy standpoint, but to let as many people know as possible that, like, yes, like, this is what, frankly, makes America great.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Scott Hechinger. He is the executive director and founder of Zealous. He's a civil rights attorney and a former public defender. So, Scott, we were just talking about this new administration and how it harkens back to British rule in the 18th century in many ways. I hesitated to read this executive order, which came from the White House on January 20th. First day Trump was in office. It says, "For too long, politicians and judges who oppose capital punishment have defied and subverted the laws of our country. At every turn, they seek to thwart the execution of lawfully imposed capital sentences and choose to enforce their personal beliefs rather than the law." And then goes on to talk about how the Attorney General shall take all necessary and lawful action to ensure that each state that allows capital punishment has a sufficient supply of drugs needed to carry out lethal injection. And then he also talks about how they need to make these people suffer in jail. They're going to be in the worst prisons possible. How do you and your colleagues at Zealous react to something like this, and how should average citizens feel?
There's a lot there. There's one, you know, piece that is just the power of language and the power of words. When you, you know, this is something that Trump and as well as prosecutors, as well as police, prison interests have been doing really well for at least half a century, which is really turn people who they claim are you know, violating the laws into actual monsters, into animals, into less than.
And we saw this with Trump early on when he dipped his toe into the criminal justice waters in the 80s with the Central Park Five.
Exactly. It's a tactic to scare people, to make people think that the laws that are being passed, you know, regardless of, you know, data, regardless of reason, are necessary in order to punish. Fear and anger are two most powerful emotions, and Trump is very good at accessing those. It's a big part, maybe the reason why he's been able to to have the kind of popularity he's had. He's really tapped into those emotions are kind of across the board. So I think about that as this is something that we at Zealous, as public, as public defenders, as folks who really truly care about public health and safety, are not like surprised by. This is the power of language, and the power of fear has been what has driven the United States to be the most policed, the most prosecuted, the most imprisoned society in the history of the world. And we are by far not the healthiest or safest. That thing one. Thing two, specific to, the death penalty, I think it's, I think back to Justice Harry Blackmun, and I forget which opinion he wrote this in, but he wrote these powerful words that, we should refuse to continue to tinker with the machinery of death. And what he was talking about was we need to not just kind of continue doing what we've been doing over the past several, decades, which is sort of limited in terms of who is eligible for the death penalty. So we've limited, you have to have committed the crime over the age of 18. Anyone under 18 cannot be sentenced to death. Pregnant women, people who are actually clinically deemed insane. There's a range of folks who are not eligible for the death penalty. He's like, we got to stop tinkering with this machinery of death. A, it's just immoral. B, we're one of the few countries in the rest of the world that still allows it. And then there's a host of things that are really critical for people to understand. I mean, number one, there's a huge number of folks who, fortunately, even after maybe having their death date, the date when they're going to be put to death, like coming around the corner, have been actually fully exonerated. And it's really, really, really hard to get a court to even look at evidence of innocence. Justice Scalia famously actually ruled that it is actually constitutional to execute an innocent person because the value of finality in the legal process trumps even innocence. The fact that one person who was scheduled to be murdered by the state has been found to be actually innocent and exonerated should be enough to end this practice where there's even a risk of that. But the fact that a lot more, hundreds of people have been exonerated who were sentenced to death in a system that is designed to actually make it really hard to prove your innocence means that there's likely tons of folks right now on death row who are innocent. So that's thing one. Thing two, it's immensely costly. Just like so costly to go through this process of trying to literally kill someone. Beyond that, the difference between, killing someone and someone being locked up forever, some folks would actually rather not die in prison. It's also just arbitrary. It depends on which state you're in, and it overwhelmingly, disproportionately has an impact on Black and brown people.
We should also mention that it's not a deterrent. There's no data that shows that ramping up from life imprisonment to death penalty is going to deter somebody from what generally is not a premeditated act like homicide.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, broadly speaking, the deterrence rationale in any kind of sentencing, people are not making a calculation when they're taking actions. And the vast majority of crime is crimes of desperation, of poverty, of substance use, of folks that are just desperate to survive. You can't deter poverty with prison. You can't deter substance use with prison.
I wish the methodology was consistent with conservative policymakers, because it seems so hypocritical. When you think about education, one of the arguments that the school choice, the anti-public school advocates are talking about is, we've tried this and it's not working. We can't just throw money at the problem. Here's some data that shows spending went up in Oregon and test scores went down in a vacuum, irrespective of the fact that, teachers were leaving the field and that there was a pandemic and that these monies take a long time to work. So we've tried this and it doesn't work. What about trying something else? But then when it comes to the death penalty, no, we have to stick with this, even though we know it doesn't work. It makes us feel good, so we're going to try this. So there's no consistency in how we approach tackling policies.
Well, first of all, criminal justice is the only area where we base policy, at least ostensibly, I think a lot of it's based in hate, but we base policy, at least outwardly, on the extreme outlier case, right? It's like, the smallest percentage of people, for example, when we talk about bail reform, smallest percentage, like the vast, vast minority, it's basically statistically non-serious or inconsequential. If one person, you know, right, like gets out and does something, we wound up overthrowing bail reform that actually had saved $100 million, hundreds of millions of dollars, where hundreds of thousands of people were free who otherwise would be locked up pre-trial, and people were home with their families, able to continue searching for work. It's like one of the most successful policies, but we focus on that extreme outlier case. But if you think about like health, like we wouldn't have any medicine if we made our decisions based solely upon the like small percentage chance that there were side effects. There's inevitably, we're humans, inevitably things are not going to work perfectly. Here's the thing though. I think we all too often, we in the movement, honestly, for health, truth, health and safety, who happen to consider themselves progressive, we tend to say, they're doing this, and we kind of focus on Republicans and the GOP. What I think we fail to think about and realize, and what I really urge everyone to think about is, what's happening right now? As Trump is doing all this stuff in the national level, what are our blue state, Democratic, so-called progressive leaders actually doing? And if you look to New York, for example, Governor Hochul, who's getting a lot of positive press, as I think she should, for standing firm in refusing to extradite this doctor to Louisiana who provided allegedly abortion pills. She, at the same time, is calling to reverse a major, powerfully successful initiative that's lasted and worked over 5 years in New York, simply that requires prosecutors to turn over all evidence to the defense in advance of trial. Whereas before, New York was in the bottom four states for what's called discovery. Discovery is just the process of prosecutors turning things over. Texas was way more progressive, was a leader in the country when it came to turning evidence over. And in 2019, when we passed this new law that Governor Cuomo signed, this is pre-Hochul, you had then Governor Rick Perry, talking about the importance of, even in a law and order state, we need to have justice and we need to be fair. We had special victims unit prosecutors and judges from Texas flying to New York to tell prosecutors that to sit down, to stop lying, that it's actually, that this works really well for all toward justice. So right now, literally right now, as we're rightfully up in arms about what's happening in Washington, what's happening on the national level, and the way that Trump is talking about things like the death penalty and like our immigrant neighbors and like our trans friends, Democratic governor in New York is actively working against the interests of justice. And so it's like, and this is true all over the country. In Philadelphia, same thing, you know, Mayor Cheryl Parker is tearing the city apart in ways that are, and I could go into them more, but they're blue state leaders. And I think we as progressives tend to, especially in moments like this, lose focus and focus solely on the real horror like Trump. When right in our backyard, where we actually have, I think, more ability to push forward progressive ideals and demand change from our leaders, we're sort of just like letting them get a pass. And so it drives me nuts. Hope more people pay attention.
How much do I know to talk out of turn? You might say that I'm young, you might say I'm unlearned, but there's one thing I know, though I'm younger than you, even Jesus would never forgive what you do.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Scott Hechinger. He is the executive director and founder of Zealous. He's a civil rights attorney and a former public defender. I remember when Trump first came to power, we just immediately said, well, we still have local government and we still have communities to lean on. And I think that's more important than ever. And I think the work that you and your colleagues at Zealous are doing is very important on not only a national level, but on a granular one as well.
I appreciate that. And, you know, could I, there's this another example going back to, okay, we've talked about, you know, Republicans in the GOP, we've talked about sort of the vices, in my opinion, of Democrats still. But in Mississippi, there's a really interesting example right now. One of the things we're trying to think about is, like, where can we still try to make forward progress? In Mississippi, of all places, there's this really interesting growing momentum that's cross-political, across the political spectrum, across interests, around a criminal justice issue that I think it's important for people to know about. You have conservatives paired up with libertarians, paired up with racial and social justice advocates and fiscal conservatives, faith leaders, to push for Mississippi becoming the best public defense system in the country. Right now, there are only 33 full-time public defenders in the entire state. It's the most under-resourced public defense system in the country, which leads to people literally being locked up indefinitely because they literally don't have a lawyer just to say, hey, judge, there's someone locked up pretrial, cost a fortune. But it's interesting. Mississippi's politics are such that libertarians are very, very interested in public defense because it stands as a bulwark against the heavy hand of the state and supports civil liberties. Conservatives who claim to value the Constitution, this is the Sixth Amendment. This is right there. Fiscal conservatives, cost a fortune to lock up people unnecessarily and keep people from their jobs. It has major economic impact. Racial justice leaders, this has been really interesting, were some of the hardest folks to get onto squad public defense because, understandably, are folks that are trying to push for a healthier and safer policy that's outside the criminal legal system that actually helps instead of harms people. It's sort of hard to immediately understand how investing in the system, ostensibly public defense, actually gets us to that state. But it's happening right now in Mississippi. You have a governor who is actually really committed to this. You have a Supreme Court of the state who just issued a ruling, a new court rule that requires public defenders not only to be there at the very first hearing, there aren't many, when bail is set, all the way through the rest of the case. So this is something that I'm really excited about that we're working on, and it's really incredible to see, and it's something maybe in a sea of horribles to give people a slight glimmer of hope. Not in bipartisanship, but in the fact that there is still forward progress in maybe one of the least likely places. And if we can win in Mississippi, that's a domino effect to, I think, the rest of the South. And then you get to talk to blue state leaders and say, look, you have a system in Mississippi that is better than yours. Like, do you want to be less progressive than Mississippi? And use that to shame them maybe into doing better.
Scott Hechinger is the executive director of Zealous. People can go to zealo.us to learn more about the organization. Scott, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Always a lot of fun talking to you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by the JBs, Sly and the Family Stone, and Eddie Vedder and Mike McCready. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.